You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the 6th to the 12th of November 2014. My name's Chris Parr, I'm joined by editor John Gill, writers Matthew Rice, Holly Elson, Jack Grove and books editor Karen Shook. Up to 200 applicants are chasing every early career post at top universities in the UK, according to a THE investigation. That's our splash this week, and Jack will tell us more in just a second. Is the UK HE system geared too much towards 18-year-olds? Holly and Matthew have been looking at what we stand to lose as the number of mature students declines. Our second feature this week is an account of John Gill's interview with Sir Steve Smith, Vice-Chancellor of the University of Exeter and former President of Universities UK. And Karen Shook is here to give us a rundown of the no doubt plentiful highlights in this week's books section. But first, Jack, your splash. Fixed-term research posts, often viewed as a stepping stone to permanent academic posts. Sounds like a nice job if you can get it, but it seems many simply can't get it.
Yeah, these are the posts that PhD students coming out of their universities are hoping to get, and they're seen as pretty important because it's often quite hard to get a full permanent academic post where you can research and teach. So often these fixed-term posts are very important, and some of the success rates are really quite alarming, really. For instance, at one at Clare College, where they advertised a single science post, there was 230 people applying for it, and we saw 200 people applying for every post at various other Cambridge colleges. At an Oxford College, it was 127. At Birmingham, there was 433 applications for six research fellowships last year, and that it sort of just shows how tough the job market is for PhD students. And I was actually at a conference yesterday, and the Vice Chancellor of Leicester, Paul Boyle, was speaking about the European Research Council, and he said that there was a 6% success rate there, and he called that was quite worrying, saying that 94% of all applications were basically wasted.
Yeah, that's quite high compared to some of these.
In this case, it was like 0.5% or 1%. So it just shows how tough it is. And I talk a little bit about to some experts saying that PhD students need to have a sort of a plan B just in case.
I mean, that's not a perfect comparison, is it? There's some difference between the wasted effort of applying for research grants, which is we do as an annual story, the kind of Research Council success rates, and the wasted effort of applying for a job as an early career researcher and PhD. It's not quite the same thing.
Well, you say that, but it is actually quite intensive because you have to work up a proposal, you have to put in quite a lot of groundwork. You don't just fill in a form.
No, absolutely.
You have to work up a very serious proposal and do a lot of legwork, and
but it's individuals applying for jobs rather than, you know, employed serving researchers wasting time that they would be better off spending at the lab filling out in research grant forms. It's not quite the same opportunity cost there of time spent filling out forms versus work that you could be doing. I take your point.
There's people trying to get into a position where they can waste time.
Yeah.
Filling out forms.
I mean, this is an issue that Holly, you write about week in, week out, isn't it? The kind of career crunch that comes after the PhD, and what do you do next?
And just the sheer increase in the number of PhD students out there being produced by universities looking for these jobs is also part of the story. That, you know, the numbers graduating have increased quite significantly in recent years.
I suppose it's very difficult to say what's to be done. I mean, you can't produce new full-time positions out of thin air, can you?
No, but they are very limited, and there's a sense that, you know, lots of younger researchers are being put on, are having to take teaching-only posts where it's very hard to then produce a research output where you can then get promotions and move up the academic ladder. So these posts are seen as particularly important, and there's not many of them, and people are chasing after them.
And those are really interesting figures, and a lot is made of the universities that have these grand schemes where they say we will be, you know, hiring 200 of the best and brightest, and they're great schemes. But when you look at the size of the disparity between supply and demand of these sorts of positions, it becomes clear what a sort of desperately difficult step it is to take in the career progression from PhD into sort of proper, you know, research research post.
Indeed. Well, the full write-up of that story, which came off the back of an FOI request by Times Higher Education, by you, I imagine, Jack, is on page 6 and 7 this week. A bit further back in the magazine, in our features section, Holly and Matthew, you shared the load of this week's cover feature. It's all about mature students, and well, it brings some interesting findings and some interesting stories to the fore.
Okay, well, I did it. I wrote it. I suppose it's a sort of human interest story, looking at mature students, and indeed going back to some of the people who had experience in mature students in the 1970s, and just looking at the issues of what that does for a class, how it benefits. Not only the mature students themselves, but the younger students, the people who are teaching, and the general level of debate. And so implicitly what is lost when you don't, where it's all, the whole class is full of callow 18-year-olds. And, there's some good stories. I remember one woman who taught at the University of Sussex and in the 1970s, early 80s maybe, and there were quite a lot of mature students in the humanities, and they were almost always women who'd had children and then come back. And she said the sort of running joke was that almost all of them had left their husbands by the time they'd finished the course, just because they're not only exposed to interesting ideas but all sorts of other temptations. And it certainly was life-changing for some of those people.
Yeah. And Holly, you've been crunching the numbers.
Yes.
The sort of bring around some fairly shocking statistics.
Yeah, so we looked at really what's happened to the numbers of mature students in the last decade or so. And since 2008-09, their numbers have actually dropped in terms of first-year undergraduates who are mature students by 150,000. That's quite a significant decrease. And in England, it's been particularly bad. It's a 37% drop in the number of mature students starting out in their first year. And there's a number of reasons for this. The fee hike has something to do with it. The recession, meaning people are less able to pay for things like an education. And the fact that employers are actually less likely to put their hand in their pocket to help their staff get degrees in the recession, and with the new fee regime.
Yeah, but I mean, there's a graph there that you put together on page 39. It really, really illustrates the point very clearly that it's in England where these numbers are declining, which would suggest it's all the fees, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, these employer issues will be common across the UK, but it's that one point that sort of significantly differentiates between the countries.
Yeah, that's what a lot of the experts who I spoke to said, and particularly for part-time mature students, this is where the fees really start to hurt, because they're not actually entitled to the loans and grants for living costs that full-time students might be able to accrue. So it just makes it's another financial burden for them to have to overcome.
I think the other thing, I mean, this has comes on the back of a whole bunch of hammer blows for mature and part-time learning and lifelong learning. We had the ELQ rule that came in some years ago, where suddenly there wasn't funding made available for second degrees when you had an equivalent or lower level qualification. And that really hit numbers very, very hard. You know, institutions that specialise in part-time and mature learners like Birkbeck really struggled off the back of that. And this is, you know, really hit them again. And I spent some time at Birkbeck recently and was talking to Joan Bakewell, who's Chancellor there, and she was talking very, very passionately about, you know, saying the problem is that mature students, you know, lifelong learning is seen as a very middle-class pursuit. It's kind of, you know, retired middle-class housewives in Surbiton doing, you know, second degrees to fill their time. That's not what it is at all. When you actually go and look at Birkbeck, look at who's doing these courses, they're incredibly inspirational stories of people that are really transforming their lives at a later date. You know, they're not 18-year-olds coming out of school and going straight into it, but they are kind of coming back to education with a real passion and enthusiasm and a reason to be doing it, which sometimes you don't, you know, you might not find amongst every school leaver doing it for the first time. So it's a real tragedy that's being kind of, that aspiration and that widening participation issue further down the line is being hit in quite the way that it is.
Yeah, and I think what a lot of the people are saying that I quote, that it's not only very sad for those people who are missing out, but that it's greatly You know, it makes the experience for the younger students and indeed often for the academics less interesting and stimulating and satisfying as well.
Variety is the spice of life. That's on page 36 this week. Do check it out. Maybe we should go to our books section now, change the order slightly. Why not? Karen, what's on the menu this week?
Well, from lifelong learning to lifelong scholarship, one of our reviews this week by Robert Eaglestone from Royal Holloway is of the latest book from Roger Grenier. It's called Palace of Books, probably the latest in a series of books about books, or what Joyce Carol Oates called the bibliomemoir. But one of the interesting things about Roger Grenier, who is reflecting on literature of various varieties, is that he was born in 1919. He was old enough to have worked with Albert Camus on the journal Combat. So when he talks about the fact that claims that there's too much media attention on the private lives of, say, authors and other people in the arts now, he can say with some authority that this was a problem for Sartre and de Beauvoir as well. Mm-hmm. Also this week we have a review by Irene Glendinning from Coventry of a book by Claire Gartland called STEM Strategies, Student Ambassadors and Equality in Higher Education, another great book from the Institute of Education Press's series of books focusing on UK higher education. This looks at the STEM ambassadors to schools who are undergraduate students themselves at two universities, slightly anonymised Royal, which is a Russell Group institution, and Bankside, which is a post-92, both based in London. And it looks at where these succeeded and where they did not. And in a lot of cases, there seem to have been inbuilt problems with the way they were carried out. Or there are also questions about whether these activities, which obviously extremely well meant, succeed in getting anyone else to study STEM subjects who hadn't already been intending to do so. Also this week, Fred Ingalls reviews a new book by Raymond Tallis, Summers of Discontent, The Purpose of the Arts Today. Obviously a very eminent scholar in the sciences, considering the value of the humanities, of the making of books about the value of the humanities by serious scholars, there is no end. Also this week, we have Lawrence Coop reviewing a book by another UK academic, Teresa Belton, called Happier People, Happier Planet. Now, there's no shortage of happiness studies, usually by behavioural economists at the London School of Economics. Teresa Belton looks at it from a slightly different perspective, and she looks at what being a happily modest consumer would involve. And our book of the week this week, reviewed by Philip Hoare, a wonderful writer on the sea himself at the University of Southampton. This book is a slightly more chilling side to the oceanic experience, The Last Beach, two academics who specialise in coastal science, giving us facts such as, if you go to a remote Hawaiian beach, 70% of the beach will be made up of bits of plastic.
Mm, interesting stuff. And since we last had you on, the latest books podcast is out, of course, with Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein. That was quite a read. Quite a listen. I listened through to that just before it went live. It's an interesting chat.
Fantastic scholar at the New College of the Humanities and also at Harvard, and she's written a book called Plato at the Googleplex. If you haven't listened to the podcast or checked out that review, I can really recommend it. It's a cracking book.
Yeah, you'll find that where you found this podcast. Finally, John, you're the author of our second feature this week. You've been speaking to Steve Smith, Vice-Chancellor of Exeter, and as the introduction to your piece points out, the UUK president who supported the trebling of tuition fees, and often that's used as a stick to beat him with. What sort of brought this piece around?
Well, it's 4 years, almost to the day, since the student protests. You remember the protests where they sort of invaded Millbank Tower and threw the
fire extinguisher.
Fire extinguisher at the top, which became the flashpoint that we'll remember from those fee protests. And 4 years on, it all seems an age ago, but of course 90% of what we write about week in, week out has stemmed from that period when the £9,000 fee regime was introduced, and it brought all sorts of trends and tensions and issues with it. And Steve Smith was really at the heart of that sort of policy making machine then, if you like. He was there really sort of shoulder to shoulder with David Willetts, then Universities Minister, as they kind of drew up the plans that came to be implemented following the Brown Review. And I think Steve Smith has certainly had some very fierce critics at the time and since as well, from students through to sort of fellow vice-chancellors, and of course the people who we hear from still very regularly, who are big opponents of the sort of marketised higher education sector. So I had a lunch with Steve, and it was a kind of lunch with THE, if you like. That was the kind of premise of this piece. And it was a chance to have a really kind of in-depth chat with him about, you know, 4 years on, looking back on that time, what the compromises were, why they were made, why in his view they had to be made, you know, how he responds to the critics who've you know, continue to come after him quite fiercely. And I think he's very candid in the interview. He talks very much about, you know, the details of how those policies were thrashed out, the fact that, you know, he says every political party made it very clear to him and others in the sector that, you know, there were big cuts coming, whichever party was in power. And so, you know, he really felt that and continues to feel that the deal that was done was in the best interests of the sector. But he also goes into some detail about some of the sort of personal attacks on him and how it affected him personally as well, because it's not easy, I'm sure, to be, you know, involved in such a momentous decision and have people, you know, disagreeing with you as fiercely as they did. So it's really just picking through a lot of those issues and just hearing the kind of human side of this tale as well from somebody that was there at the heart of it. And yeah, I think it's a good read.
Yeah, page 40 this week for analysis of all those points that John brought up then. That's all for this week's THE Issue Review podcast. You can comment on any of the stories we've discussed, or indeed any of the stories in the magazine or on our website at timeshighereducation.co.uk. You can also do it on Facebook, on Twitter, on LinkedIn, in all the usual places. But until next week, that's all from the THE Issue Review podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.